This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Paul Hoover and Maxine Chernoff are two well-known poets who live in the San Francisco Bay Area. Hoover has published 11 books of poetry, including Poems in Spanish, which was nominated for a Bay Area Book Award, and Edge and Fold, his most recent publication. Chernoff is the author of 6 books of fiction and 10 books of poetry, including her latest collection, The Turning. I'll be airing a show with them reading their own work at a future date. But tonight it is my pleasure to focus on a book of translations that Chernoff and Hoover worked on together, The Selected Poems of Friedrich Hölderlin, released by Omnidon Publishing in 2008. The book won the Penn USA Translation Award in September of 2009. Friedrich Hölderlin was a German poet born in 1770, whose work was first published in 1791. He died in 1843. There have been many excellent translations of his work, but the Hoover Chernoff selected represents all of his major forms and makes clear why Hölderlin is considered to be one of the world's greatest poets and the foundational poet of European Romanticism. Here is a small sampling from the very comprehensive introduction to the book written by Paul Hoover. Even though his poetry was not widely celebrated in his lifetime, and he suffered from mental illness for half of his life, Friedrich Hölderlin has come to be considered one of the great poets of European and world literature. Because of his complex syntax and themes, the proto-modernist fragmentation of his late works, and the influence of his thought, Hölderlin now outstrips Goethe and Schiller as the valued poet of his period. A profound influence on Rilke and Heidegger in his mystical concept of the open, as well as on transcendental idealism in Hegel's philosophy — Hegel was his roommate and Schelling a classmate at a Lutheran seminary — he is the subject of numerous studies. A Hellenist who addressed the gods and was the first to grieve their departure, he is a major figure of Romanticism and contributed well in advance of Nietzsche and Heidegger to the development of existentialism. Hoover and Chernoff visited me in Sonoma County recently to record some of the poems from the Selected Poems of Friedrich Hölderlin.
I'd like to start by reading a poem that represents his love of the gods. So that's Sung Beneath the Alps. It's from the later odes. Holy innocence that men and gods love the most, either inside the house or out of doors, you sit at the feet of the ancients, always full of contented wisdom. For man knows much that's good, but astonished as the animals he looks toward heaven, but how pure everything is to you, pure one. Look, the rough beast of the field gladly serves and trusts you. The voiceless forest speaks to you of the ancients. The mountains teach you holy laws. And even now what the great father wants to name for us, who have much experience, only you can clarify and brighten. To be alone with the gods, and when the light passes over, and wind and flood, and when time hurries to its place, you have a steady eye for them. Nothing is holier that I know and want, as long as the flood doesn't take me, like the willows, well cared for, sleeping as I must on the waves. He who holds divine things in his heart will gladly stay home, however, and I'll be free, as long as needed, to translate it and to translate and sing in the tongues of heaven.
I'm going to read a poem called Tears. Heavenly love so tender, if I should forget you, you who are marked by fate, you who are fiery, full of ash and waste, and even before that, you who were lonely and desolate, dear islands, eyes of the world in wonder, since only you matter now, you banks on which for the sake of love and on to heaven alone the godless say their prayers. For almost too gratefully in the days of beauty, furious heroes and the holy serve there, and there were many trees, and the city stood there at one time, visible like a man lost in thought. Now the heroes are dead, the islands of love defaced, almost disfigured. So forever love is outwitted and utterly absurd. Yet, soft tears, don't completely extinguish the light of vision for me. Still, to help me die nobly, you frauds and thieves, let one memory live on in me.
I think you can feel some of the modern tendency in Hölderlin, like sleeping as I must on the waves, for example. It's quite startling. Hölderlin had a tendency to rewrite his poems and to reuse entire sections of his poems. So to exhibit that, we might want to read The River in Chains and Ganymede, which are neighbor poems, companion poems, written one after the other. The River in Chains. Why do you sleep and dream, young one, so wrapped up in yourself, and linger patiently by the cold bank, and pay no attention to your place of birth, you, son of oceans, friend of titans? The messengers of love, sent by your father, don't you recognize their life-breathing winds? And doesn't the word strike you, which the painful god sends you, bright from above? Already it sounds in his breast, wells up, as when he played in a womb of stone. And as he weighs his force and strength, now he hurries, this slacker. And now he mocks his chains, and takes and breaks and throws the broken pieces down in anger, playing here and there on the echoing banks. And the voice of that god's son wakes the mountains all around. The woods begin to stir. The deep ravine can hear the distant herald, and shivering joy stirs in the earth's bosom. Spring arrives, a new green dawns. But he wanders toward the immortals, for he has no place to stay, except to be received into his father's arms.
This is Ganymede, and again, you'll be able to hear some repeated lines from the previous poem. Why do you sleep, son of the mountain, so crookedly, ill-tempered, and freeze on the bare banks? Too patient? Don't you think of grace when even the gods are thirsty at the table? Don't you recognize your father's messengers where sharper winds cut through the ravine? Doesn't the invitation of a well-traveled man strike home its ancient meaning? Now it resounds in his breast, deeply welling up, as when he slept high upon the rock. In anger now, the one in chains bathes himself, and now he hurries clumsily. Now he mocks his chains, and takes and breaks and throws them down, drunk with anger, playing here and there, as the riverbanks observe him. And at this stranger's peculiar voice, the resting herds rise, the woods awaken, and deep in the land you can hear the river god's voice, and stirring at the earth's core, the spirit shudders once more. Spring comes, and everything in its own way blossoms, but he is distant, no longer there. Now he strays off. Geniuses are all too good. He chats away in heaven now.
Friedrich Hölderlin lived in southwest Germany in the Palatinate, and it's an area of rivers. So he was drawn by the Rhine, the Donau, also known as the Danube, and also known as the Ister. One of his famous poems is the Ister, made much of by Heidegger. And he embodies the river as a force of imagination. Philosophically, I think he comes out of Heraclitus originally. So he's a poet of change and transformation, dynamic in that romantic way. Here's a very short hymn. Hölderlin is known mainly for his hymns and fragments. So we're reading from the hymns and early odes right now. This short poem is called Half of Life, or Hälfte des Lebens. Weighted with yellow pears and full of wild roses, the land flows into the lake. Drunk with kisses, you lovely swans dip your heads into calm and holy water. But oh, Where shall I find flowers when winter is here? And where the sunshine and earth's shadows? The walls stand speechless and cold. In wind, the weather vanes clatter.
And that poem, Half of Life, is particularly poignant because at Holderlin's halfway point in life, in his 30s, he went mad. He no longer was capable of taking care of himself. He was housed for more than 30 years at the home of a man named Zimmer, who took care of him in his madness, and his writing was never the same. So he only was a well-known and flourishing writer through the age of about 37. He lived almost 40 more years after that, pretty much unable to write with this effect anymore. This poem is called Remembrance. The northeast wind blows, dear to me because of its fiery spirit and the good voyage it promises sailors. But go now and greet the beautiful Garonne and the gardens of Bordeaux, where on the steep bank the path runs unevenly and the brook falls deeply into the river, while above a pair of noble oaks and white poplars face the water. I remember this so well, and how the broad elm with its leafy top leans over the mill, but a fig tree grows in the courtyard. On holidays the brown women walk on silken ground. In the month of March, when nights and day are the same, and over slow paths, a light breeze blows, heavy with dreams of gold. Won't someone pass a fragrant cup full of dark light, so I can rest sweetly and sleep among shadows? It's not good to have mortal thoughts, but lack a soul. But a little conversation is good, to express the heart's meaning, to hear about the days of love and everything that's happened. But where are our friends, Bellarmine and his companions? Many are afraid of going to the source, for wealth begins in the sea. And like painters, they bring together the beautiful things of the earth and don't disdain war's outspread wings, nor years of solitude beneath the leafless mast, where the city's holidays don't gleam through the night, nor the sound of violins or local dancers. But now the men have gone to the Indians, there on the windblown peak and the vine-covered hills, where the Dordogne flows from its source, and together with the brilliant Garonne, broad as the sea, its current flows out. But it's the sea that offers memory and takes it back, and love, too, fixes its attentive gaze. But what endures comes from the poets.
Heidegger speaks a lot about that last line, but what endures comes from the poets. In other words, poetry is at the heart of philosophy. The Heraclitean reading is essentially a poetic one, right? You don't step in the same river twice because it flows on. So the lesson is embodied in image and in metaphor. So it's a poetry of beauty and a poetry that faces joy and despair equally, which is typical of Romanticism. The men wander off to the Indians. It's such an odd development in that other poem. And we had to translate that two or three times thinking, can that possibly be right? De Indian is the phrase, and it can't mean anything other than the Indians. So in Germany in the 1800s, there was a great romance to be had about the United States, or the continent where the United States was to be found, North America. And flyers were being handed out by development companies, getting people to move to North America, which was portrayed as an ideal, a paradisical kind of location, full of colorful birds and fertile fields. And indeed it was. This comes from fragments of hymns. It's called On Yellow Leaves. And if you had the benefit of looking at the page, you would see some of its fragmentary nature. The line in the middle, for example, "So busy," is isolated from the stanzas around it. on yellow leaves. The grape rests on dying leaves, a promise of wine, as the shadow of a gold earring rests on a young woman's cheek. And I must remain alone, but the little calf is entangled in the chain which it has torn loose. So busy. But the sower loves to see a woman asleep at midday over a stocking half knitted. The German tongue is not easy on the ear, but lovingly plants its kisses from a prickly beard. Now that image of the little calf entangled in the chain from which it itself has torn loose can be studied as an emblem of the dilemma of freedom. Hodrenin himself could be seen as having entangled himself in the chain which he had torn free, or perceived to be free in, for example.
This one is called Tinian. It's sweet to get lost in the holy wilderness and drink, O kind spirit, at the wolf tits of the waters that wander through my native land to me. Wilder once, but now like orphans accustomed to the taste. In spring, when unfamiliar wings return to the warmth of the woods, resting in solitude, among the willow trees, full of fragrance, where butterflies mingle with bees and your Alps. Divided from God, the divided world, indeed they stand armed and wander as they wish, timelessly. For the gods hazard us a falcon's glance, or like gladiators the gods decree these outward signs to be birthmarks of whose child the West must be. Some flowers don't grow from the earth, but sprout in loose soil of their own will. Counter light of our days, nor should one pick them, for they stand golden, prepared only for what they are, leafless even as thoughts.
That's one of my favorite poems of Hodrenin. And the striking character of his imagery. There was controversy over T.S. Eliot's line about the evening lies like a patient etherized upon a table. In his poem Prufrock, right? Huge controversy. And yet here we have, hundreds of years before, the German poet saying, O kind spirit at the wolf tits of the waters that wander through my native land to me. Brown women walking on silken ground and the gods hazardous a falcon's glance. I mean, this is very muscular, striking imagery. It's not the decorative imagery we associate with romantic and lyric poetry. So in an earlier poem, for example, the counter light of our days, or won't someone hand me a cup of dark light? As if that would be comfort. Here's a very short poem from the section of our 500-page book. It's called Der Baum, the tree, and it's Plans and Fragments 24. That means that he left behind, scattered among his notes and his manuscripts, fragments, which were then gathered by the scholar Friedrich Beisner, who did the definitive edition, and numbered them as fragments. See? So there are about 116 fragments altogether. This is 24. The tree. When I was a child, I planted you. Lovely tree. How different we seem to each other now. How splendidly you stand there. And like a child.
So the fragments, as you just heard, sound rather incomplete, and that's why they're fragments. They're not poems that he, in his lifetime, went back to and filled out if he were going to do that. And we don't know if he was going to do that or not. This is another fragment, number 26, called But Speech. God speaks in thunderstorms. Often I've had speech. It said anger was enough and suitable for Apollo. Do you have enough love to contain your anger also? Often I have tried to sing, but they didn't hear you. That's what sacred nature wanted. You sang for them in your youth. Not singing, you spoke to the Godhead. But this you have all forgotten, that the first fruits belong to the gods, not mortals. Fruit must become more common, more every day, before it has any meaning for those with the gift of death.
We took a liberty with the gift of death. They're the Unsterblichen, the gods, and the Sterblichen, those who can die, who have the gift of death. The gods don't die. That's their dilemma. I was going to say about the concept of the fragment in Hölderlin. I think as modern thinkers or as postmoderns, we sometimes think of the fragment as being completed by its incompletion. That is, the charm of it is its curtailment. Suddenly standing there, the fragment finds its completeness in its very incompleteness. A new resolution is found other than the one that seemed to be sought. There's a great fragment called In the Forest, Im Walde. This is a Sattler compilation. D.E. Sattler is a German scholar, still living and producing, who had a plan for the fragments. He saw how they might be compiled into poems as originally intended by the poet Hölderlin. And he studied and studied what might be considered overwritten or palimpsested manuscripts. Hölderlin would write in the interstices of his manuscripts over and over. And so it makes for very difficult manuscript reading. And Sattler gave himself to that plan. And this is a wonderful result of that. So understand that these are fragments of Hölderlin put together by Sattler. In the Forest. You noble beasts, but man lives in huts dressed in shame. The more inward he is, the more attentive also, and protects his spirit as the priestess protects the heavenly flame. This is the limit of his understanding, and why his willfulness and greater ability to succeed and fail are given him, godly creature. And of these powers, language is the most dangerous, so that creating, destroying, being annihilated, and returning to her, the mother and mistress, bear witness to what he is, having learned from her the most godly and all-preserving love.
He remains nowhere. No sign binds, not ever, a vessel to contain him. Good things come in threes. I have no wish to destroy your symbols. And keeping the sacrament holy holds our souls together, the ones that God gives us, life-sought companion to the end.
By all means, differences are good. Each and every has its own existence. The dark leaf and its perceptible growth and the Syrian soil crushed and flames underfoot, burning and nausea overcoming me from desperate hunger. Friedrich with his bitten cheek, Eisenach, the famous, Barbarossa, Conraden, Ugolino, Eugenius, Heaven's Ladder, Time's Departure, and they leave each other in peace. Thus Mohammed, Rinaldo, Barbarossa as free spirit.
Emperor Heinrich, but we confuse one time with another. Demetrius, Pollio, Syrcites, Peter the Great, Heinrich's crossing the Alps, and with his own hands he gave the people food and drink, and his son Conrad died of poison. Perfect visionary, reformer, Conradine, etc., all relations characteristic. Hear the watchman's horn at night, the fifth hour after midnight.
Tenda, Stromfeld, Simonetta, Teufen, Amicle, Aviro on the river, Vuga, the family, Alan Castro, its name therefrom, Amalasuntha, Antigon, Anathem, Ardengelos, Sorbonne, Celestine, and Innocent interrupted the lecture and named it the Nursery of French Bishops. Aloysia, Sigea, Differentia Vitae Urbanae et Rusticae, Thermodon, a river in Cappadocia, Valentino, Schoenberg, Scotus, Schoenberg, Tenerife, Sulaco, Venafro, region of Olympus, Weisbrunn in Lower Hungary, Zamora, Jaca, Baco, Imperiale, Genoa, Larissa in Syria.
When the vineyard is in flames and looks black as coal around the time in autumn, because the reeds of life breathe fire in shadows of the vines. But how pretty when the soul unfolds in this brief life, and the sky becomes a painter's house with all his pictures on display, near Thebes and Tiresias, the ground too barren for me.
Like the man who eats men, he who lives without love, and describing shadows his eyes would fill with anger. Quite simply this time, but often something happens inside one's head, impossible to understand. But when a free man goes out for a walk, he finds the path waiting. As for the horses, an endless desire for life, as when nightingales sing their sweet home song, or the snow goose sings with longing above the circle of earth.
Stripes of blue lilies, do you know the work of artists alone, or like deer roaming in the heat, not without restrictions? Narcissi, ranunculi, and syringas from Persia, flowers, carnations cultivated in pearl and black and hyacinths, as when instead of music heralding an entrance, there's the scent of an evil thought. My son should forget to enter loving relationships in this life. Christopher's dragon has exactly nature's walk and spirit and shape.
He should take everything except the long ones to a pure place where someone scatters ashes and burns the wood with fire. From pagan Ayobaca, let them learn to work with their hands and by the same means be forward or avenged. Vengeance, in fact, should return to its source. While we are raw, don't let God lash us with waves. To be sure, we are godless, common folk all, whom God tests like nobility. Yet it's forbidden to boast about this. But the heart knows a hero. It's for me to speak of my fatherland. Don't begrudge me that. In the same way, a carpenter makes a cross.
Sword and hidden knife when sharpened more or less well. But don't let our native land become too small a place. Heavy is the, to lie at rest, feet and hands outstretched, only air. Knavish and comical to smile when man's boldest hopes come true.
I must build and erect new temples of Theseus and the stadiums where Pericles lived. But there is no money. Too much was spent today. I entertained a guest, and we sat together.
That was Paul Hoover and Maxine Chernoff, translators of the Selected Poems of Friedrich Hölderlin, published by Omnidon Press. Before moving on to our next guest this evening, Rebecca Faust, here is a musical interlude. The wonderful singer Ian Bostrich with Julius Blake performing a composition by Robert Schumann, from Dichterliebe in Liederkreis, Opus 24. This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM.
Ich wanderte unter den Bäumen mit meinem Kram. Alte Träume und Schicksal.
dies Wörtlein gelehrt, ihr Vöglein in Luft gehört. Schweigt still, wenn mein Herz es höret, dann tut es noch
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guest today is Rebecca Faust. She's the author of two books, Dark Card, which won the Robert Phillips Poetry Chapbook Prize in 2007, and Mom's Canoe, which won the same prize in 2008. This could look suspicious. Some contests truly deserve our suspicion, but it turns out that this competition is totally blind. The contest is run by the Texas Review Press of Sam Houston State University in Texas, and none of the judges know who has written the poems they're reading. So this really says a lot about these two books winning two prizes 2 years in a row. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
My pleasure. Let's get started with Dark Card. The poems in this collection are about raising your son with Asperger's syndrome, which is a type of autism. And even though a lot of our listeners will be familiar with the terms now, because 46,000 school children in California have been diagnosed with autism, perhaps before we turn to your poems, you can give us a definition of this syndrome.
I'm glad you asked that, Catherine, because Asperger's is really a very special kind of autism. Autism is a spectrum, and at the very most dysfunctional end, the children are truly nonverbal. And at the opposite end, the highest functioning end, where we find Asperger's, some people wonder if it really even should be on the spectrum. A name that people have often heard applied to Asperger's syndrome is idiot savant syndrome, or Rain Man syndrome, based on that movie with Dustin Hoffman that came out in the 90s. Children with Asperger's tend to have very high IQs, and some of them even have savant-like abilities. I was told by more than one person that in another culture, a culture other than ours, my son might have been considered a shaman. He does have several of the savant abilities. He has an acute sense of sight that has been measured by optometrists. As well as the sight, he has an unusual sense of taste. He can distinguish the taste, well, as I say in my poem, between brands of pickles and pickles bottled at different seasons. And he also has some of the more expected savant abilities in math and cognitive functioning. He has a photographic memory, for example. So I hope that answers your question. It's a spectrum. It is increasing. We don't know why. It's not just a matter of greater diagnosis. More and more children are showing up with autism, but it's this interesting combination of strengths, which I've already described, and formidable challenges in the social functioning area. And the way I normally describe this is, these children can't read facial cues or body language. So a lesson that it would take a normal child a week or 2 weeks to learn, for example, how close not to stand in an elevator, might take my child 3 years to learn, because he wouldn't hear the or see the finger shook in disapproval, or the eyebrow, he wouldn't see the eyebrows raised. So he wouldn't get all those cues, and it would take a year or more of me reminding him and teaching him by rote not to stand too close to someone in an elevator. So that's the example I give to people.
And I guess also that one of the things that happens with these kids is their brutal honesty, right? They will speak very bluntly, maybe hurt some other kids' feelings, and certainly not meaning to do that.
It's true. I mean, one story I love to tell to illustrate that principle is my son wrote a paper in high school. They were asked to write a paper after reading Catcher in the Rye about what do they find the most phony in their life. And my son's chosen topic was the public school system.
Oh, see?
and this teacher was one that was very supportive of my son. She was the last person in the world whose feelings he would have wanted to hurt. And when not only did he choose this topic, but when she asked for a volunteer to read the paper aloud in class, when the principal was in the room, he raised his hand and read the paper. The teacher was mortified. Her feelings were horribly hurt. And when my son was told that he had hurt his teacher's feelings, he was horrified. It just had never occurred to him that that would hurt anybody's feelings. So that's an example of the kind of thing that can happen.
Well, you've written a fair number of readings from this book all over the Bay Area. Did you find that people that don't usually attend poetry readings attended yours because of the topic of autism?
Yes. I just had a wonderful illustration of that because my book launch for Dark Card was at Book Passage on September 13th, and 160 people attended that reading.
Oh, my gosh.
And I just had my book launch for Mom's Canoe 3 days ago, and I had 60 people. So that kind of illustrates the point very graphically. Mm-hmm. But what was really wonderful about the reading in September is that several people with autism attended that reading. One was a 20-year-old boy who came up to me afterwards and asked if we could have lunch after, and we did. One was a little boy who was 12, and he actually stole the show because during the question-answer part at the end, he raised his hand and said, you know, I have autism, and then he paused and he said, and sometimes I have very dark days.
Oh, my gosh.
Just brought down the house. Oh. I mean, I was practically sobbing when I answered his question. So, yeah, it's been very gratifying. Many people have emailed me from all over the country whose children have autism or brother has autism. And that part of it has been really gratifying for me because it's reaching people on a completely different level than you normally get to with poetry.
So it sounds like that these people have really ended up helping you in unexpected ways.
They have. Meetings. They have. For one thing, you feel less alone. I mean, before I turned to poetry, my full-time work was in advocacy and grassroots political organization of parents of kids with autism. But that tended to be business and shoring people up and making sure they could assert their rights. And it wasn't spending a lot of time just talking about the feelings that people have. And since then, since I wrote the book, a lot of people have emailed me or called me, and I definitely feel less alone. And the more people you meet, the luckier you feel, because it's like anything else. You realize, as bad as it may seem at times, other people have a much harder time. I met one mom who has three kids with autism.
Well, we learn a lot about the birth of your son and much more by reading Dark Card. All kinds of emotions show up, grief for sure, but some well-aimed anger and more before the final transformation near the end of the book. Many of the poems, though not written in form, still manage to feel to me as if they were, as if they started from a place of form and then morphed into free verse. Is that a correct assumption?
You know, these poems really came straight from the subconscious and from the heart. I had no formal training in poetry whatsoever when I wrote these poems. I started writing poetry really as a result of taking a writing class at Book Passage 3 years ago. I had studied poetry in college. I had always kept a journal. I loved the formal poets in my youth. I loved Donne. I loved Herbert. Mm-hmm. I loved Yeats, and evidently had absorbed the music of those forms. Mm-hmm. My mother read formal poetry to me as a child. Things like The Charge of the Light Brigade, mm-hmm. poems, Kipling, a lot of poems that had strong meter and strong music were read to me as I was a child, and I absorbed those forms, but really had no idea what I was doing. And the books in Dark Card basically came from one of those college-bound journals that I kept. I have a small walk-in closet, and I would keep things together during the day, and at night I had a little stool that I would sit on, and I would basically tear...
In the closet.
Mm-hmm. I would tear my hair, weep, rant, rave, and write in this journal, and that's when I let it all out. And that journal became Dark Card with very little revision.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't start with poems in form and then take them out.
Well, if I asked you to read all of the poems I have flagged in Dark Card, we'd need a full hour just for this part of the show. But why don't you go ahead and read some poems from Dark Card?
I'd like to start with the title poem from the book, Dark Card. This poem is about the otherness of kids with Asperger's. One of the hardest parts about parenting a child like this is that people don't accept anything that's different, particularly other children and also parents of other children. But the book has an arc, and I think the epiphany comes in the book and came for me when I realized that I myself was one of the people that was not accepting my son's difference. And it came to me at a certain point that I was trying to pass him off as a little professor or a little genius as a way of masking that he was really just different. And at some point I realized it was really okay to just be different, whether or not you were brilliant along with that. And that's what this poem is about. Dark Card. When they look at my son like that, at the grocery store checkout or at school assemblies, I wait for the right moment. Till they move through laughter, raised eyebrows, clamped lips, but before fear. Then I switch gears, go into my tap dance and shuffle routine. Yes, he's different. All kids are different. Him, just a little bit more. Oh, he's knocked down the applesauce pyramid. So sorry, here. My sleeves conceal napkins for messes like this. And I can make them disappear. But before I do, make sure you marvel at how the jars made an algorithm when he pulled that one free. Oh, he was standing on his desk again, crowing like a rooster in your third period class. Yes, bad manners. And worse luck that he noticed how today's date and the clock match the hour of what you taught last week in a footnote, the exact pivotal second of the Chinese year of the cock. Before they get angry, I pull out my deck, deal out what they want. Yes, he's different, but look at his IQ score, his math SAT. I figured out that difference pays freight when linked with intelligence. Genius trumps odd, alchemizes bizarre into merely eccentric. So I play the dark card of the idiot savant, trotting out parlor tricks in physics and math. He sees solutions the way you might breathe or perceive the color green. It's my ploy to exercise their pitchforks and torches, to conjure Bill Gates when they see him, or Einstein, not Kaczynski or Columbine. Perhaps they'll think him delightfully odd or oddly delightful. Dark anime eyes, brow arc calligraphy on rice paper skin, his question mark flower stalk spine. But it's a swindle, a flimflam, a lie, a not celebration of what he sees with his inward turned eye. The patterns in everything. Traffic, dirt piles, bare branches of trees, matrices in jar stacks, Shang dynasty history in tick of school clock, music in color and math, the way shoppers shuffle their feet while waiting in line, how he tastes minute differences between brands, even batches within brands of pickles and cheese. How he sees the moonlit vole on the freeway's blurred berm. The next poem I'd like to read is called Apologies to My OBGYN. And a strong theme in this book is the individual against the institution, the struggle that these kids have and that their parents have getting what they need for their kids from the schools, from the medical establishment, and from the it's basically the schools and the medical establishment. When my son was born, he suffered a terrible birth trauma. A lot of things went wrong, and the prognosis was not good. And we were told by many doctors over and over that he would die. But as you'll see from this poem, he had other plans. Apologies to my OBGYN. Sorry that my boy birthed himself too early. Took up so much room in your prenatal nursery with his 2 pounds, 2 ounces, and did not oblige your nurses with easy veins. Sorry we were such pains in your ass, asking you to answer our night calls like that, and that he did everything so backwards, lost weight, gained fluid, blew up like a human balloon, then shriveled. Sorry about how he defied your prognoses, skyrocketed premiums, weighted the costs in your cost-benefit analysis, skewed bell curve predictions into one long, straight line. Sorry he took so much of your time, being so determined to live. He spent today saving hopeless case nymph moths, trapped in the porch light. One matrix dot at a time, and now he's asleep. Blue wingbeat pulse fluttering his left temple, there again, just like it did then. The next poem is it's really dear to my heart. In fact, at one point I made a pledge that I would never do a reading without reading this poem, and I realized I just broke that pledge last Saturday night. But when my son was in middle school, he had the hardest time of all his years socially during the middle school years. Kids are cruel, and no time more cruel than the middle school years when kids are looking very carefully at each other and figuring out who's different and who doesn't fit in. And he was bullied. He was teased unmercifully and bullied physically. And this poem takes its title from a book by the same name, written by Rebecca Heinlein. It's a how-to manual for parents of Asperger's kids, how to deal with the bullying problem. Perfect target. How they'd leer when he walked up to them with his face flower open. Then one would shrug a book ballasted backpack to sprawl him out flat on the asphalt. How they'd tell him that the teacher wanted, no, really wanted him, to jump on the lunch table to see if it would break. The apology note after note after note that he dutifully wrote. How at bath time he'd say the bruises and scrapes were nothing, nothing. Leave it alone, Mom. Don't make it worse, Mom. How one time they cornered him behind the storage shed and stoned him in a hail of green oranges, left him face down, blood snotted in dirt. How he braided in three strands the lanyard of his middle school years, the hours and hours spent pacing the playground alone, the playdates and parties he was never invited to, the chairs pulled away just before he sat down. I'm happy to report it got much better when he went to high school, and it got better because of what happens with kids. They stop looking all around and they start looking at their own navel. And because kids become so self-absorbed in high school, they don't pick on other kids as much. And he did this wonderful transition from being victimized to being anonymous, which was such a huge improvement. And it allowed him to heal. And he eventually made friends. He made a set of four or five friends who are his friends to this day. He's 21 now, he's in college, and he still has the same friends he made in high school. High school was a lot better. The next poem I'm going to read comes from one of the darker sections of the book. Parents of kids with differences have a lot of fears, and this is about one set of those fears. And it's also about what we were talking about earlier, the instinctive honesty that these kids have. They're as clear and transparent as glass, but not because they're morally better than the rest of us. They simply can be any other way. It's just their makeup. He never lies. He never lies, not because he won't or doesn't know better or how. He just can't. I imagine him telling too much of a truth, or hellbent on one of his endless circular descents, the spiraling descent into his own brand of ineluctable logic. Mom, you say that you aren't the only one who thinks I should shave, but you are the one saying it, so it's only your opinion, even if you say that you aren't the only one who thinks I should shave. I fear he'll be over blunt, or otherwise by accident draw their attention, their anger, their rage. I fear how far they might go to assuage their discomfort. With difference, I imagined him drugged or locked down on a ward. In my nightmares, he's caged. Most of you are probably aware that when Hans Asperger came up with the name Asperger syndrome back in the 50s, the prevailing view was that autism and Asperger's was actually caused by not the parents, but the mothers of these children. And there was a belief that the mothers were cold and withholding emotionally, and that they robbed their children of the ability to formulate emotion, to cognitively be able to express or even feel emotion, hence the term refrigerator mothers. And everybody, that's been thoroughly debunked and no one believes that anymore. But what I found in my own experience when seeking desperately for a diagnosis for my son before we discovered that what he did in fact have was autism, I did find myself up against several different doctors who suggested that I perhaps was the cause of my son's problems. And that's what this poem is about. Refrigerator Mom. They called them cold and withholding refrigerator mothers, indicted them with their kids' autism. You did it too. You soulless suck of a self-righteous so-called psychologist, with your walks outside and your talks up in trees that never leafed out. You wasted time sitting mute next to my son's muteness for 2 years, getting your other work done, explained how my helicopter mothering was causing the problems, how maybe I was the one that ought to be medicated, and it was convenient for a time having me Paxiled. No more second-guessing the doctor's advice to chill out. No more nagging about homework, chores, computer, TV. I learned the art of aloof, how to sleep when awake, how to speak softly or not speak at all, how not to feel desire or desire to weep. For nearly a year in our house, a kind of peace reigned until one day it cracked and rained pieces of everything, propellers, coils, struts, random refrigerator parts. This next poem, it makes me happy because it marks a real turning point in the way I looked at my son, which was I've heard other parents of Asperger's kids say this too, but at some points you look at your kid and you're feeling all this pain and all this worry, and you realize that they're actually having a really good time. And if they're not being bothered or shoved into a corner that they don't want to be in or forced to do something they don't want to do, if you just let them line up their matchbox cars or count their stones in their stone collection, they are capable of incredible joy. And I tried to capture that in this next poem, which is called Asperger Ecstasy. The excitement and the difference between two pennies increases exponentially when there are 20, 100, 1,000, and he vibrates with joy. It can be tying flies under a microscope, not patterns the size of this period. It can be cataloging washing machine brands or the note variations in a symphony, or committing to memory for joyous recounting the entire year's schedule for the L train, or picking up rocks from the road, distinguishing the ones that were indigenous from the gravel trucked in. Beach detritus, what wealth lay strewn, infinite variety of shell, pebble, seaweed, and broken bits of stones. Oh, never to grow bored or experience a numbing sameness of things, to immerse consciousness in the sensory present of a bottle cap flattened by traffic, or spend a whole school day with a paperclip stylus carving whorls and curlicues and acorns given to the teacher instead of the worksheet. Each minute difference an opportunity point on which another difference can hook and turn and spread again, a thought diagram of the branches that split and resplit, blooming a pattern so rich and complex it quickly becomes chaos to us. And he's never happier than when. And I'll finish with one more poem written for my son. I think you'll recognize the fairy tale that this is from. It's called Wild Swan. What I knit at night unravels each dawn, yarn slipping like smoke from the day's bright needles. A prince once was a boy, a swan, my autistic son. It burns, his garment of nettle, his singlet of stars. The night cries are feral and awful, my hours are cloistered with wool. I make the knots faster and faster, knowing what morning will bring. From his lips, one white crescent pin feather, under the counterpane, his shining wing.
Thank you so much, Rebecca Faust.
Thank you, Catherine. It was a pleasure to be here.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Word Temple. My guests tonight were Rebecca Faust, Maxine Chernoff, and Paul Hoover, and through Chernoff and Hoover, Friedrich Hölderlin. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.